Welcome back to Winter is Here, a podcast where we discuss how we arrived at the global battle between tyranny and democracy, and more importantly, how we can win. I'm your host, Yuri Lepstein, Executive Director of the Renew Democracy Initiative. Today, I'm joined by Larry Diamond. Larry is considered one of the foremost experts on the study of democracy. He is a senior fellow in global democracy at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, where he was the former director of its Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. Larry is also a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institute, where he spearheads its program on China's global sharp power and on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. He is the co-founding editor of the Journal on Democracy and the author of numerous books, the most recent being China's Influence and American Interests, Promoting Constructive Vigilance. He writes a monthly column for the American Interest and frequently consults on policies and programs to promote democracy. And so with that, Larry, we are excited to have you join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Uriel. It's nice to be with you.
Terrific. So what I want to start off with is the sort of series of elections that we've seen happen over the course of the last week, and of course, the midterms coming up in the U.S. next week. It's clear, I think, that democracy is under threat right now, right? In many free and open societies, it's threatened by demagogues, by extremist movements from both left and right. You know, in Israel, we've just seen what will most likely be a very far-right coalition in power with an actual borderline, well, with a nationalist with fascistic tendencies likely taking on a ministerial role. In Brazil, there was a choice between fairly far-left, formerly incarcerated president in the form of Lula, and of course, the current but soon to be former president on the far right, Bolsonaro. And of course, we all know about the struggles in the US. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the world, there are authoritarian regimes like Russia, Iran, China that are threatening the freedom of their own people as well as the freedom of their neighbors. So, given all of that context, to what extent do you believe that these trends are related? Are these threats to democracy within free countries connected to the threats to democracy posed by authoritarian states?
Thank you for the question. I think that one of the most important causes of this is the rise of social media and the way it is given a voice and a platform magnified many times over to very extreme and outrageous elements. And then the demonstration effects of one extreme and anti-democratic party or leader winning, destroying democracy and kind of lighting the path for others. So I think we have diffusion effects and demonstration effects, kind of modeling effects, that probably began, well, you can trace it all the way back to Putin, but really, I think, gained momentum with Viktor Orban and his gradual destruction of democracy and manipulation of truth in Hungary, and then gained further momentum with Donald Trump and his hypercharged, sensationalist invention of threats and claims of infallibility and aggrandizement of power in a very dangerous and, I think, authoritarian way while he was president. And one example and model leads to another. Bolsonaro is drawn from that. Narendra Modi in India has drawn from that. Often these movements try to resurrect and reinterpret the past in their countries in very bold and daring ways, as Giorgia Meloni has done in Italy with her Brothers of Italy, which is now the leading party in the Italian government, where she is prime minister. They're responding to common anxieties, economic anxieties, the challenges of increased social pluralism with immigration and rapid economic and technological change. But these existed in previous eras, and what didn't exist in previous eras was social media.
So let's focus on the free world side of this equation. is your hypothesis that the reason we're seeing this trend of demagoguery, of wannabe authoritarianism in otherwise free and open societies, the existence of social media? Like, is social media essentially the direct cause of, you know, the rise of people ranging from Trump to Bolsonaro to Orban, now to, you know, in Israel, to Ben-Gvir, the ultra-nationalist figure who will have an outsized role in coalition? Is that the trend line going through it all?
I don't think social media is a cause of this, but I think it's a tremendous magnifier of this. You know, back in previous eras, we had in the United States extreme racist and kind of neo-fascist movements and violent ones, but they couldn't gain the traction that they have gained recently because they lacked a national megaphone and a truly national narrative. And so I think that social media has been a great empowering force in this regard. And I also think that diffusion effects matter. And so these authoritarian and illiberal actors are borrowing narratives, borrowing imagery from one another, drawing inspiration from one another. And when one wins a victory, that empowers others. I think there's a separate dynamic interacting, but distinct, that is also contributing to this. And it's a kind of longstanding phenomenon of politics of outbidding. And this, I think, is important to understanding Israel and the Jewish Power Party and the Ben-Gvir phenomenon, that when you go down a polarizing path and you inflame a constituency and manipulate fear and anger as a strategy for winning, it's kind of like heroin, and you need more and more of it to get high. And so the anger, the outrage, you know, doesn't flow adequately from the same old political platforms and arguments. And it's what's new and shocking that moves people. And I think that's some of what's been going on in Israel right now. And also, Netanyahu is extremely politically weak because he's vulnerable, because he's facing very serious criminal charges. So he can't push back against these actors or draw any moral boundaries, frankly, because he's so desperately dependent on them. Not just to assume the office of prime minister again, but to stay out of jail.
Since we went down the path of social media, I mean, and given that this is all anyone can talk about, I have to ask, what do you think is going to be the impact of Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter?
I think he's going to destroy Twitter and certainly diminish its potential civically, because he doesn't bring any lens, any apparent lens. I hope I'm wrong in the tentative judgment I'm coming to, but I don't see any evidence of him bringing any kind of civic impulse or any sense of democratic responsibility to his acquisition of this company and his plans to operate it. Trump was knocked off the platform for a reason, having to do with some sense of, you know, responsibility to democracy as a whole. And you could argue, well, it's time to give him a chance again or not. But I worry that Musk has misguided libertarian tendencies, because a true libertarian ought to be concerned about preserving the larger context of freedom, right? I mean, if you really believe in liberty, you want institutions that are strong and resilient and credible enough to protect liberty. And what the level of polarization that we're seeing now driven by social media and disinformation is doing is challenging the entire architecture of this. So I think a lot of these extreme libertarians are very short-sighted. Senator Mike Lee's principal challenger in Utah, Evan McMullen, is, I think, a study in contrast. He's also a libertarian or has got strong libertarian instincts. He's a principled conservative independent with libertarian instincts. But I think he's got a much keener appreciation for the overall responsibility we have to protect democracy.
So, you know, as you sort of hinted, I think Elon would make the argument, because clearly he and I are on first name terms, but I think Elon would make the argument that he is supporting democracy by virtue of his defense of free speech, right? A fairly absolutist approach to the defense of free speech. And of course, I think there's any number of arguments that we can make around how free speech should not necessarily guarantee you a megaphone. And, you know, you can make any number of algorithmic arguments about how the Twitter algorithm actually promotes the most aggressive and extremist speech at the expense of more reasonable, modest, nuanced rhetoric. But nevertheless, he would make some kind of free speech argument, and sort of the inherent implication in some of what you said around kind of defending the context of democracy as a whole implies restrictions on free speech and some, you know, within some context or some framework. And so I guess first, how would you see those restrictions working, right? I mean, presumably you would have to have some element of consistency in application. But more broadly, if we assume that the existence of social media is what allows extremist movements to become much more viral than they otherwise would have been. I mean, of course, I think back to the Nazi Party in the United States prior to World War II and their huge rally for thousands of people in Madison Square Garden. You know, God only knows what that would have looked like if they had had Twitter or Facebook to propagate their beliefs instead of essentially being limited to a single place in the country in a single time. So having said all of that, what should be done? What do you think can be done on social media to try to limit the spread without, on the other hand, kind of going too far and limiting the existence of an open and free town square?
Well, I'd say the minimum is ambitious requirements for transparency in the algorithms that these platforms are using to elevate and push content. And that is what is called for in the bill that Chris Coons, Rob Portman, and Amy Klobuchar introduced into the Senate, something like the Platform Accountability and Transparency Act, PATA, that requires the social media companies to make available to qualified, vetted researchers, for example, those who have funding from the National Science Foundation, their data, user data, and the data behind their algorithms. So independent researchers can make judgments about what these companies are doing and what and how they are pushing and elevating certain kinds of content. It's not just that this content gets put up on Twitter or Facebook or YouTube or whatever. It's what happens to it once it gets put up. It's the automatic ways that the platform algorithms are driving this content. And we know why they drive, push, elevate this kind of shocking, enraging, polarizing content, because it makes them money. The angrier that people get, the more shocked they are, the more infuriated they are to the point of wanting to take a hammer to the knees of the Speaker of the House, beginning by smashing in the glass door of her home in San Francisco. The more infuriated they are, the more shocked they are, the more angry they are, the more time they spend on the platform. The more time they spend on the platform, the more ads they see, the more ads the company sells, the more data the company collects, the more revenue it gains. The revenue model of these companies is very perverse, and that goes to the core of the crisis we're facing right now.
So by implication, wouldn't the fact that Elon Musk is considering a subscription model for Twitter rather than being purely advertisement focused, wouldn't that actually be an improvement?
I have to tell you, Uriel, that half of me hopes that Musk goes to a subscription model and an extremely expensive one. I would be at this point happy for him to charge each user thousands of dollars a year, because I think at this point we might be better off with the company destroyed by it becoming the conveyor belt for hatred and suspicion that it risks becoming even more so under Elon Musk's ownership. But of course, I say I'm half-hearted in my aspiration for that, because I also know what a valuable neighborhood square Twitter has been for people to be able to share their views, their opinions, their news, their perceptions, their developments. And so in reality, I would hate to see it destroyed. I think that the question is not whether there's going to be a subscription fee, because if there's a subscription fee, people are still going to be either given disproportionately polarizing information or not. And if you think that Twitter is going to become more responsible simply because it's getting subscription revenue, I think that it's a leap of faith to assume that. I think the proof will only be in the viewing. And I don't see any indication from what Musk has said or done so far that the mere addition of a subscription fee is going to change that. Moreover, the problem is with the most highly motivated and conspiracy-minded users of these platforms, those who regard the platform as a kind of crack cocaine that they can't be without, will probably pay $20 a month in order to access it. And then they may go deeper and deeper down the rat hole of misinformation and fear and hatred-inducing flow of angry messaging.
I appreciate you using the term rat hole instead of rabbit hole. I think it's a little bit more evocative of the emotion we're going for here. So before transitioning over to authoritarianism in the unfree world, I want to try to imagine what solutions to this could be. So you noted the bill that Coons, Portman, and Klobuchar have put forth, the PATA, PATA bill, and you noted the impact that would have on algorithmic transparency and things like that. Do you think something along those lines would have the kind of impact that would take the wind out of the sails of the sort of pro-authoritarian movements in the free world? I mean, it just strikes me as insufficient, right? It strikes me as there's got to be a whole lot more going on here that has empowered, you know, these sometimes proto-fascist, you know, the anti-democratic, whatever forces that, you know, are really riling up countless countries now in the free world.
I think that there is great value in passing that legislation and in gaining the greater transparency and understanding from the research. So there are two aspects to the bill, the transparency and the accessibility of the data for research. I think there's great value in that for trying to diagnose the problem and begin to restrain it. But I have no illusion that that's going to be even close to enough. Anna Eshoo, our local congresswoman here in the Stanford area, and Tom Malinowski have introduced a separate bill, a much more daring bill, in the House of Representatives that would lift Section 123 immunity under the Federal Communications Act for social media platforms that are, I forget the exact language, basically conveying misinformation and disinformation in a way that has the potential to do harm to specific groups on the basis of race, ethnicity, or something like that. And that's a very controversial bill because Section 123 immunity is regarded as a kind of holy grail for the health of the Silicon Valley, the social media ecosystem. And I have mixed feelings about the bill, but I think we definitely need more far-reaching regulatory structures. And the problem here is that you do run the risk of throwing out the baby with the bathwater and damaging freedom of expression when you engage in excessive regulation. And so it's just very hard to know where the boundaries should be. I do think we can't put all of the burden on government, that we need more vigorous research and advocacy from civil society and the breeding of a more civic culture and habits of critical thinking and independent verification by the young people that we're unleashing into this ecosystem. And so I think there needs to be some kind of mandatory training in the schools of how to use social media responsibly. It's obviously just training. People can toss it by the wayside once it's over. But some people, I think, will become more cautious in simply taking at face value everything they see on the internet.
Yeah. You know, as I think about possible solutions to this, I mean, quite frankly, nothing comes to mind as a short-term solution to the rise of authoritarian movements in the free world today. But in terms of mid to long-term solutions, a whole, you know, host of things come to mind, most of which have to do with education. It's really striking to me how, since the end of the Cold War, we essentially correlated democracy with economic success and basically made the argument that democracy is useful insofar as it brings economic prosperity. The implication of that being that as soon as that economic prosperity was called into question, you know, with the 2008 recession and the beating that the markets have taken, you know, that they took then and they're taking now, it calls into question the efficacy of democracy. And it opens us up to arguments that, well, maybe alternative systems are just as good or better. You know, I think we failed to make an argument in support of liberal democracy on its own merits. And I think we're reaping the rewards of having failed to do so. Does that strike you as an accurate description?
Yes, it does. And I think it underscores the need to go back to basics in terms of civic education as democracy education in the schools, in terms of grounding education in overarching common values that the society should share and want to elevate, in terms of promoting not just understanding of what democracy is, but why, independent of the outputs it produces in terms of economic and social welfare at any period in time, it's the best form of government. And that, in turn, requires a close interrogation of what, over a long historical period of time, what has been the track record of authoritarian regimes in terms of destroying human freedom, in terms of massive kleptocratic corruption, in terms of the kind of atrocities we're seeing now in Xinjiang province, in terms of the arbitrary jailing and silencing of people simply for what they think and believe. And ultimately, as we're seeing in China now, the consequences, even for economic development, when you don't have a truly independent state and authoritarian regimes kind of accelerate to their ultimate logic, which is one man, whether it's Hitler or Mussolini or Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin, for that matter, making all the decisions without any measure of transparency, debate, or accountability. What you get in that regard is the Ukraine invasion or the lockdown of a country of 1.4 billion people for 2 years during the COVID-19 pandemic.
As we're now starting to talk about the authoritarian world, I hear a whole host of folks basically saying, look, our hearts go out to the people affected by authoritarianism. We sympathize with the Ukrainians, but ultimately we've got our own problems at home. We've got poverty, we've got homelessness, we've got countless other things, not to mention the fact that our own democratic house isn't exactly in order. What is the connection between our fight for democracy at home and the fight for democracy abroad? Is there one?
Well, it's a case I tried to make in my recent article in Foreign Affairs. My argument is in the title, All Democracy is Global. And I think we have seen throughout history that when democracy is under siege in one part of the world, and authoritarian values and mechanisms, and now very alarmingly with regard to the People's Republic of China, authoritarian surveillance technologies are being disseminated and diffused around the world, democracies everywhere are at risk. And when an autocrat or an aspiring authoritarian ruler develops a model, a playbook for democratic destruction, as Orban and Erdogan have, for example, what I call the autocrat's 12-step program, they provide a kind of guidebook for other aspiring autocrats to dissemble democracy elsewhere in the world. So both positive and negative models diffuse and are borrowed and adapted by other actors in the world. And when one country goes down, I will use the word again, the rat hole of authoritarian fear, disinformation, and repression, it empowers and provides tools and examples to autocrats elsewhere. And I think in the end, we have interests in the world that can't simply be reduced to freedom and democracy, but we also have learned throughout a very painful world history that if you don't fight for common values and fight against authoritarian narratives, that very bad and dangerous things happen in the world. So people are more secure in their freedom in one country when there's more freedom globally around the world.
As we think about the state of democracy globally, you've made the argument that the United States has no clear strategy to disseminate the values of democracy. So I want to challenge you here. In your eyes, what would a coherent strategy look like? And what would we need to do to achieve it?
Well, first of all, we would have a serious instrument, organizational instrument for public diplomacy to respond to all the running sewers of disinformation and authoritarian propaganda around the world, to promote and elevate objective truth, and to empower journalists and media enterprises of various forms around the world that are trying to convey objective and truthful reporting and democratically informed analysis to their societies. So one of the ways that would look like is that we would once again have a U.S. information agency, as we did, you know, probably from the 50s until the 1990s, that was dedicated purely and energetically to this mission. Secondly, I think that we need to do much more in terms of democratic assistance, financial assistance, to support independent media around the world, some civil society organizations working in partnership with Omidyar Networks, Luminate, developed a concept for an independent fund for public interest media around the world to mobilize potentially billions of dollars in a kind of multilateral collaboration to support independent media, generally probably online media, in their struggles to break the hegemony of authoritarian propaganda in countries like Russia and China and so on, and have authentic reporting coming from those societies and finding innovative ways of broadcasting or conveying back into those societies. But there's very little prospect that these kinds of independent media are going to be financially self-sustaining. You know, what's the market going to be? Maybe they'll be able to sell some advertising, but, you know, it's not likely to be self-sustaining. So if we want objective news and information to flow in these countries, if we want investigative reporting to uncover the scandals of these authoritarian regimes, we have to get serious about supporting it. And I think that's an enterprise that's going to probably require several billion dollars of investment a year. But you look at what we're investing in development assistance overall around the world, or the tens of billions of dollars that we've now provided to Ukraine for its defense as a result of a particularly dangerous and, I think by now, clearly aggressive authoritarian regime in Russia seeking to undermine that. And, you know, you put then this kind of investment in perspective in terms of the overall cost. The third thing is that we need to do much more specifically at the level of intellectual understanding and normative appreciation of democracy. And this requires, I think, a complete multilateral, multicultural reboot of the case of the essence of democracy and the case for democracy, noting the multiple cultural traditions and origins of liberal democracy. It's not just a Western concept. Noting the many ways in which peoples around the world are struggling for democracy. Noting the public opinion data of overwhelming support across different regions and cultures for basic democratic principles. And then systematically translating the core body of scholarship and philosophical writing that we have on democracy as a system of government, its essence, its advantages, its challenges, its different institutional forms, the conditions for its successful emergence and operation or its failure, codifying this extremely rich body of scholarship and normative thought, and translating it into 10, 15, 20 or more different languages around the world, and then finding ways to convey this body of knowledge that, first of all, can reach different cultures around the world, different countries around the world, and second of all, reach young people where they are in the kinds of ways that they now consume information. So it might not be just a dry parade of essays. It might be short and creative video clips with kind of musical accents. And we've made almost no investment in this, almost none. It's well, the autocracies
and those that have made investment in that are the exact bad actors that we don't want.
Yes, that's my point. They're the ones that are investing in information that pushes their normative viewpoint.
Before we close here, I want to change tack a little bit. I think that was a pretty thorough view, and you know, for what it's worth, I think I'm entirely aligned with it. I've been just shocked at how, you know, the only content that I, or rather the content that I see online that's most engaging and most dynamic and pushes the envelope is almost always from the most extremist sources. I don't see the reasonable kind of moderates coming out with really dynamic content. You know, it reminds me of the joke that moderates are the worst to be in a protest, right? Because when most people are protesting, you know, what are they shouting, right? What do we want? Change. When do we want it? Now. Meanwhile, you know, moderates at a protest and they're like, what do we want? Incremental change. When do we want it? Whenever it is economically and politically feasible. But anyway, and so obviously we need to change that perception because I don't think that that's actually what a moderate should be. But setting that aside for a moment, the theme of what we're kind of talking about today is how interconnected everything is. And one of the things that you've really, I think, highlighted over the course of the last few months is that, you know, and here I'm going to quote you, that there is no more important priority than ensuring that Russia's brutal war against Ukraine's democracy ends in Moscow's defeat. And you were making this point as it relates to the safety and security of Taiwan and other countries that are threatened by authoritarian regimes. So can you talk a little bit more about that? If our priority is ultimately to counter an incredibly powerful China and to defend Taiwan, right? I mean, whose destruction would be catastrophic, not just from a moral and ethical point of view, but also from a strategic point of view in that, you know, they're the prime source of semiconductors and so forth. Say a bit more about how Ukraine's victory would actually have a positive impact globally.
First of all, you only have to look at the map in Europe to see how strategic Ukraine is in terms of its placement between, I think you can put it this way, East and West. Second of all, Ukraine is a bellwether, and which way this conflict goes will powerfully shape the calculations of potentially aggressive autocrats elsewhere in the world, not only in China's sphere, I'll come to China in a minute, but potentially globally about what they can get away with. Keep in mind that everybody is watching what everybody else is doing. This was true in the 1920s and 30s. It was true elsewhere in the world beyond. And they're drawing conclusions about the resolve, in this case, of the Democratic West to stand up to aggression and also the capacity of a supposedly soft democracy that wonderfully values freedom of expression, but isn't in the habit of military self-defense. So they're drawing judgments about what works, what they can get away with, and what the resolve is of free peoples in general and the Democratic West in a supporting role. I am sure that Xi Jinping is watching very closely what Ukraine is able to do, and also the staying power and resolve of the West to ensure that a free and democratic country can't just be invaded and swallowed, whether whole or in part. And if Russia were to suffer the kind of punishing defeat that it deserves to suffer as a result of this aggression, I think it's going to have a very sobering effect, not only on Chinese political leaders, but on Chinese military leaders in terms of the risks and costs that they may incur in launching aggression of this kind. The second point I would make is that we know that there are lessons that Taiwan must learn from Ukraine about vigilance, about military readiness, about whole of society mobilization for collective self-defense. And so Taiwan specifically better be able to learn those lessons. And the society is going to gain, that is Taiwan society, a much greater sense of self-confidence, hope, and resilience if they see that Ukraine can actually prevail. And one of the things that I'm trying to do now is promote active learning from the Ukraine conflict and the remarkable story of Ukraine's heroic and resilient self-defense, to promote learning from there to the current drama that is unfolding with ever-increasing danger across the Taiwan Strait.
On that, what I would say, cautiously optimistic note, I think that we can close out. So thank you, Larry, so much for joining us. And thank all of you for listening to this episode of Winter is Here, brought to you by the Renew Democracy Initiative. I'm your host, Yuri Lepstein. At RDI, we are committed to pulling American democracy back from the brink and restoring its place as a global beacon for freedom. If you'd like to support the show, please subscribe for free in your podcast player at renewdemocracy.substack.com and share the episode with a friend or become an RDI subscriber at rdi.org. Thanks.